Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Circle Cinema is currently featuring its third Oklahoma Jewish Film Festival, and tonight will feature a special showing of a documentary of a man and a time when it seemed that Middle East peace was within our grasp. Rabin, in his own words, a documentary autobiography that tells the story of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In his own words, featuring audio and video interviews, archival footage, home movies, and private letters. Rabin was a warrior who worked for a lasting peace, who was assassinated by zealot citizens in his own country in 1995. The film recounts his role in building the Israeli Defense Forces, the architect of the Six-Day War, his move to diplomacy, and his role in preparing the way for peace with Egypt during his first prime ministership, and his role in finding peace with the Palestinians in the Oslo Accords and with Jordan. My guest today is Yitzhak Rabin's son, Yuval, who is chairman of the Israeli Peace Initiative. He'll be a special guest for the 7 p.m. screening, and we'll host a question and answer session after the film. Yuval Rabin is my guest today. Yuval Rabin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your father was an amazing man. This film, Rabin, in his own words, points out a man of war who became a consummate man of peace until violence struck him down. How did this project come about? It's really an autobiographical documentary because the whole thing is done in his words. I guess those came from various interviews over the years, or...
Obviously, over the years, he's given multiple interviews over electronic and written printed media. There are some handwritten documents, starting from private letters to other notes and other documents that he wrote personally. The research that the producers have done is outstanding.
And yet there seems to be a lot of film of what seemed to be private family times, vacations and the like. Was a member of your family an amateur filmmaker or home movies or the like, or what?
My father was a...
He was a photographer.
He was a photographer, and I inherited, and so did my son. We all inherited the passion for photography. I think when I was around 12 or 13 years old, I was transferred the responsibility for movies was transferred over to me, and I was the one who shot the Super 8, many of the Super 8 footage, especially those that date anywhere from 68, 9 and onwards, clearly were taken by me. Those were the years that we lived in Washington, D.C. My father was Israel's ambassador to the United States, and that about that time was when I was handed over the Super 8 responsibility.
So we see your handiwork in the film.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, I could have, certainly looking back, I could have done better, but...
Well, one of the amazing parts of this documentary is the transformation. Well, not really a transformation, but your father's journey from being a warrior to being a warrior for peace. What do you think sparked that?
So I really don't view this as a transformation. I actually view this as a very consistent direction and understanding of Israel's needs. And Israel needed at all times, first and foremost, the security, but also the integration with the rest of the world and the region. So I think there's a very clear and consistent line in my father's years, throughout his entire lifetime, of taking care of the country as a whole and not just one aspect of it. It's first, and as I said, first and foremost is its security, but I think we should remind ourselves and note the speech he made introducing his second term cabinet in June of 92, which I think for the first time he defined Israel's security, and as he said, not just in terms of the number of fighter planes, tanks, and missile boats, but also in terms of the social resiliency, in terms of the neighborhood, he said, and employment, education. And you can't separate those. You have to look at it as a whole. A nation armed to its teeth with major social issues is not a resiliently strong country. So it was all about the sustainability of the Zionist project in the land of Israel that it was all about, which is, again, composed of the social and military strengths of the
country. Do you think those words were prophetic, given what's happened since his death?
I don't think about it in terms of prophecy, but I think it certainly is a legacy and something to be followed. I think that this issue of sustainability is crucial. And there are trends in Israel that we need to, and not just in Israel, of course, but in Israel is, of course, my interest, is that make a lot of people uncertain about their future in the state of Israel.
What trends in particular are you talking about?
The doubt in the value of democracy, the doubt in values of free press, free media, the doubts in the privacy. All these lead to concerns about one's future in a country like Israel. And I said, it's not, I think these are trends that we experience worldwide. But
yeah. Well, and certainly when you're concerned about your security, those become sort of the issues that come in doubt due to the seriousness of a security issue.
So it's always a question whether the security issues are the reason or the excuse.
Yeah, and that's true.
I very often wonder whether these are easy excuse to put aside many issues. And I think this is exactly what the change my father brought in 92 when he came back into office. Is that we can no longer put aside the issues that makes one's life reasonable in a country. And I think that when he came in, you know, it was after a long decade, sometimes referred to as the lost decade, the 80s.
Right.
When Israel was sunk in the Lebanese mud, we had near economic collapse, with close to 800 to 1,000% inflation a year. When we first witnessed the uprise of the Palestinian, otherwise known as the Intifada, and in a whole decade that the country was consumed in just protecting itself, so neglected pretty much every aspect of a nation's infrastructure, from roads to education to welfare. And he came in precisely for that reason, to put content into his election slogan, which was changing the national priorities.
And there's a really interesting sequence in that film which gives us a sense of how he was really out to transform the entire, I'm not sure if this was in the occupied territories, but it was Palestinian laborers building a road. You know, they're telling him, we do this for 10 shekels a day. That's two packs of cigarettes a day. And, you know, you're seeing that he's taking this very seriously.
Yes, I think he's taken many of the issues, again, those issues that were, that I view as neglected, into a priority, and it had to do with Israel's periphery, with the Jewish and the non-Jewish one. And there were, and to date, many of the non-Jewish communities in Israel view those 3.5 years as the golden era of the minorities in Israel, where the changing of the national priorities brought the priorities to those who never felt part of this whole enterprise. And again, it's not only the non-Jews, it was also for the Jewish periphery. When I'm asked, you know, what do you think was your father's biggest achievement? So the first thing I always answer is that I do not commit to giving the same answer every time, because I do have my perspectives change. But clearly one of the things that I think made a huge, significant change is the legislation he passed, which finally built the major thoroughway or highway called Highway 6 or the Rabin Highway, which really connected the country together. It's the first toll road. It's the first private-public partnership type of project that Israel did. And it's a real social revolution in allowing people from the outside of the very influential, financially strong Tel Aviv metropolitan area to come in and work and do their business and go home to their residential communities. So it's both symbolic and real practical change that made the country. It's the decision to finally, after so many years, to invest significantly in the road infrastructure, in the railway infrastructure.
So that the nation's connected as a whole?
So first of all, to connect the nation internally and to connect the nation externally. The decision to rebuild the Ben-Gurion airport, the TLV airport, was a decision taken by my father. Mm. It was called Ben-Gurion 2000. It was in anticipation that we will get a mass tourism wave in the year 2000, and in preparation for such a... Unfortunately, other things happened, and the airport wasn't ready, and other things happened in 2000, and we did not receive the... But planning ahead was another evident characteristic of my father. Planning, and execution.
Well, the film Rabin, in his own words, tells his story from his very beginnings, where we find that he really wanted to be a farmer before he went into the military. Went into the military basically during the World War II years, and that became his path. But he really wanted to be a farmer. And then the other thing that was really interesting was his first prime ministership. We think of that as sort of his spell was sort of the end of the labor coalition that had run the government for a number of years. He had to step down before actually the election. What was really interesting to me was, of course, the bitterness that we saw in his second prime ministership was already growing in that first prime ministership, where opponents of peace were already really attacking your father at that particular time, as he was just trying to find a partner, which eventually would become Egypt, to make peace with.
I think that's a very interesting observation and very accurate one. I think the common understanding is that his first term wasn't a very successful one. I actually think that it was almost short of remarkable. And I want to explain. He came in 8 months after a pretty devastating war.
This would be the 73 war, Yom Kippur
war. The 73 war, which was an intelligence fiasco. Israel was caught unprepared, and we paid very dearly in the number of casualties. Pretty much the entire, what we called our regular army, for, staffing the two front lines in Syria and Egypt, almost annihilated. 70-80% of the troops and the equipment on the front lines when the war broke out were destroyed and killed. Huge blow to the economy. Not you know, when you have a country mobilized for 6-8 months, and worst of all, it was the loss of trust in the establishment. A lot of blame throwing in this direction and other direction. And under these circumstances, he became prime minister, and I think the country went nothing short of a miracle recovery.
And he would be a logical choice. He was the head of the IDF when he had its greatest victory, the Six-Day War. So it's a natural turn.
So it was a sort of a generation handover to the next generation. But so much has been achieved internally and externally. Rebuilding of IDF. While, again, in the same way as in the second term, starting to worry about the internal issues, the internal social divide, the internal conflict, and laying the foundations for agreements with our neighboring countries, which will eventually materialize in the next term of late Prime Minister Menachem Begin. But the foundations were, without a doubt, laid out in his term. He was the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit an Arab country, officially, but in secrecy. It was in Morocco. Mm-hmm. And it's probably an issue for another program, but he had a very, very different vision for how the peace process should be addressed and achieved than the final one that was eventually signed by Menachem Begin.
The film makes this very clear that You know, I think most Americans think of it as Menachem Begin being this sort of cold warrior, if you will, in Israeli-Palestinian and Arab relations, and sort of having a Nixon and China moment. Mm-hmm. That's sort of our perception, but what the film makes clear was Rabin was leading up to being that person at Camp David with Anwar Sadat to make peace, but it's just an election intervened in before that could happen.
Well, I think that we have to be a little bit more precise than that. Yeah. And the facts are that my father still had the pleasure, let's say, of being the prime minister when President Carter took office.
Yes.
I believe he was the first foreign leader to visit the new White House. And they were worlds apart. My father was in complete disagreement with President Carter on the approach to the peace process, to the point that he was accused of jeopardizing U.S.-Israel relationships and the whole Megillah, as many Jews here say. And for whatever reasons, and I'm not criticizing, I'm just sticking to the facts, but for whatever reasons, it was eventually Menachem Begin that accepted Carter's plans, which prior to that were unacceptable, and that is the recognition that there are these people called Palestinians. So the first time Israel ever recognized the existence of these people. Of course, they tried to separate between land and people, but the recognition of the Palestinian peoples, as the Camp David Accords refer to them, was made by Menachem Begin. The plan for the 5-year interim period through which the final agreement will be reached. And there was nothing in the Camp David Accords that precluded any option, including a Palestinian state. So that was a major depart from what my father had envisioned. And in a pretty good article, Ari Shavit, who is an op-ed commentator in Haaretz, wrote about 6 months ago, he labeled my father's period, the first term period, as the Rabin Sadat paradigm in the spirit of Kissinger, which was replaced by this Begin Sadat paradigm in the spirit of Carter.
Mm.
And that is a huge transition.
Yeah.
Now, anyone who is arguing with the Oslo Agreement should look at the sources at the Camp David Accord, because the transition was made there. And in fact, I think, you know, we call Camp David, you know, the Camp David Accords, but the real name was Framework for Peace in the Middle East. This was the agreement reached in 1979 by late Sadat, late Begin, and long-lived President Carter. Yeah. The first chapter in this agreement deals with Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, not with Egypt. It's only the second chapter that deals with Egypt.
Interesting.
And it's also interesting to know that this is agreed, that this is the framework for other peace agreements. So also the paradigm of land for peace, or in fact the whole land for peace, was achieved by the right-wing Begin-led government.
Hmm.
And this is something that most people either have forgotten or chosen to forget.
Now, Americans might not have known this. Is this well-known in Israel, or is it equally forgotten?
I think it's equally forgotten, conveniently forgotten. And in fact, other things that we like to forget, it was, of all people, was President Reagan, after the 88 elections, authorized State Department to start dialogue with the PLO. And it was the international conference, or the Madrid conference, that was convened in 91 in the aftermath of the Gulf War, under the leadership of the very right-wing Shamir prime minister, that Israel agreed to negotiate with a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation, which in reality accepted instructions from Arafat in Tunis.
Mm.
So these were the circumstances of 92, which were totally different than what my father left when he left office in 77. So you got two choices. You can complain about your predecessors, or you proactively
try to make the best of the situation.
Try to make the best of the situations, considering the needs. And the needs were quite huge. Neglect, 1 million new immigrants from former Soviet Union that needed housing, that needed jobs, that needed income. And also considering the fact that this is a whole new world. There is no existential threat for Israel. We have Egypt in a peace process, in a peace agreement. We have no Eastern Front with Iraq destroyed after the Gulf War. There's no there's no Soviet Union. There's only one superpower in the world, and that's the United States. How do you leverage such a situation? You identify who are your real threats, and those were identified as Iran with their effort to develop nuclear weapons and the fundamental Islamist terrorists. And for that, you try to take away all those that are from the violent circle, you take away all those that you can in order to prepare for those that you cannot. And to build this security network buffer around us by signing agreements with the remaining Arab countries.
My guest today is Yuval Rabin, the son of Yitzhak Rabin. The Circle Cinema presents Rabin in His Own Words, a documentary autobiography, tonight at 7 o'clock as a part of the 3rd Annual Oklahoma Jewish Film Festival. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. If I can talk about that second term as prime minister in our last minutes. And, you know, the film makes clear the divide in Israel between those who were interested in pursuing peace and those that were not. And your father was subjected to being called a traitor or worse during those years. And it was really telling. There was several shots of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was then taking over as head of the Likud coalition, if you will. And people are shouting death to Rabin, and he's not doing a thing about it. It's very disconcerting, given what happened. What was that period like?
That period was... there are no words to describe. And I think that what really we should learn from this period is that we learn nothing. We continue to delegitimize people of regardless of what record and experience they have because they think differently. And I'm afraid these things are happening here and just as much or worse.
You spoke out in the last month about the Trump campaign and sort of demonizing Hillary Clinton and calling for Second Amendment types to rise up.
I thought this was the point that I need to speak out. You know, having probably, a third of my life trying to reconcile with myself the fact that I was so ignorant and blinded to the looming danger on my father's life. And, you know, the movie documents those moments. And even then, you know, when seeing and feeling the pain and the insult, I never ever imagined that it can deteriorate to what it ended up deteriorating. So that lesson has to be learned by everyone everywhere. And the fact is that even in Israel, we continue to this day, and regardless if you served 40 years in the Israeli Defense Forces, if you had the Mossad or the security services, if you think differently than sort of the masses think, then you're a traitor. And this is extremely dangerous. And a recent incident showed the disconnect and the distrust from a significant part of the public from what used to be the only institution that was in the consensus, regardless what its IDF. Now, I think when the public loses trust in every single institution of the country, we have a major, major difficult and dangerous situation. I think that one of the dangerous consequences is that it does inhibit leaders from making or taking more difficult decisions that need to be taken. Clearly, I think that this is another aspect of danger. Leaders have to lead, and leaders have to lead sometimes with very unpopular steps. May it be go to war or may it not go to war. May it be compromise on some issues or you know, just even take the Bush 41 decision to raise taxes despite every promise he made. But, you know, the economy required it. So if leadership will resort only to the popular moves, that would be very risky and dangerous proposition.
One of the things this film does make clear is your father was very courageous in the face of really, you know, even I don't think there's anything in our political rhetoric that matches what your father faced during that second term, as he was working for peace under the Oslo Accords, and every little blip, emergence of violence, whether it be Israeli on Palestinian or Palestinian on Israeli, just met with this furious reaction that was personal.
Yep. So that's, first of all, I think that's, it may have been always that way, I don't know, but the personalization of politics and he is becoming just probably deterring for many, many capable and able people from joining politics. It also takes away from any real discussion. There's no real discussion. There's total inability to explain. And eventually people who think otherwise or feel that they're talking to the wall or not being listened to, they decline from expressing themselves. They're afraid of being expressing themselves. And I find this becoming much more of a widespread phenomenon because, I mean, it's much easier to say, you know, Oslo was a bad idea, it failed, it brought about devastation and death and all this, than to stand up and say, you know, it wasn't. At the same time, I know, I mean, there will always be some counter-reaction to everything that one does. Like, there's no penalty for not doing. There's penalty for doing. The public punishes for taking a measure. The public doesn't punish you for not doing anything. But there are consequences for doing nothing.
And yeah, engagement is probably better than disengagement.
I mean, of course, there may be disagreements and disputes and sometimes difficult disputes. And there are, you know, there are shifts and transitions, and the power is held by different organizations and countries and nations, but from time to time. But yeah, no doubt, engagement works better than disengagement.
Well, Yuval Rabin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Yuval Rabin is the chairman of the Israeli Peace Initiative and the son of former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, whose life story is told in the documentary Rabin in His Own Words, which will be featured at the Circle Cinema with a screening tonight at 7 o'clock as a part of the 3rd Annual Oklahoma Jewish Film Festival. Following the screening, Yuval Rabin will lead a question and answer session. Details at CircleCinema.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.